Okay. Good evening, and thank you so much for joining us virtually tonight on this program and a good Erev Shavuos. And we're here to discuss now a very weighty topic. And there are some topics that have more questions than answers. And that's certainly the case in our very weighty and serious topic that we're going to discuss tonight, which relates to issues of triage in terms of medical care, in terms of life-saving. How do you allocate limited resources? How do you prioritize when saving lives? How do you make the very wrenching decisions where to focus your attentions and your resources first when trying to do that hallowed task of saving the life of someone else? And of course, this is an issue which has been on our minds even more than usual these past 3 months. It's a question that has sadly had great currency, great relevance. How do we manage in a situation of pandemic, in a situation of terrible global crisis, when all of our resources are strained to such an extent, how do we make sure that we're making the right decisions as far as how they're allocated, as far as doing this mitzvah of saving one's life in the proper way? And the question comes up perhaps most prominently in recent discussions in terms of ventilators, respirators that are not sufficient to address the needs of all of the incoming patients. And it really is relevant to all of the aspects simply of manpower, of the attention of medical staff, of medications, of all kinds of resources. The question of how do you allocate these limited resources in the saving of another's life is a question of tremendous importance and unfortunately tremendous relevance. And the fact that there may be more questions than answers is not because of a lack of sources. Sometimes we deal with something which is completely new and we don't have any explicit contexts in the Talmud or the rabbinic sources to address it. In this case, that's not the issue. In this case, is there's an abundance of sources, and that itself is part of the issue. How exactly do we relate to this abundance of sources in terms of applying it to the practicalities of these questions? And I should say in advance that we're not going to come out with any clear answers for reasons that will themselves become evident. But highlighting what some of the questions and what are the thought processes is a crucial part of how we even think about issues such as this. And when we mentioned that there are many sources, so we'll start off with two that seem to define some of the parameters, some of the outer boundaries of this issue. But on the one hand, we have a passage in the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin and Daf Ayin Dalet, where the Gemara tells us that the prohibition of murder, one of the Aseres HaDibros that we read on Shavuos Lo Sirtzach, is absolute. And we are not allowed to make any calculations in terms of whether this murder is a good idea, whether it's justified, separate from the question of self-defense, which has its own logic to it. But assuming that we're talking about murdering an innocent person, we're not allowed to calculate that it seems like it's going to be a better deal, seems like it's going to be a better idea, even to save our own life, even for the purposes of self-preservation. The Talmud tells us it's yehareg v'al yavor. We have to take the consequences of not following this path. We're not allowed to commit murder, even if we need to save our own life. So there we have the Gemara on the one hand telling us that Lo Sirtzach, that murder, is an absolute formalist prohibition. On the other hand, maybe staking out another parameter, there is a Gemara in Bava Metzia, which we will discuss in more length in a few minutes, where the Gemara seems to conclude that if it's not a matter of actively killing someone else, but it's a matter of holding on to your own resources. If, let's say, you have water that you need to drink to stay alive, and someone else with you also would need that water, you are allowed, perhaps obligated, to keep the water for yourself. And in that case, your self-preservation does decide the issue. So on the one hand, we have the Gemara in Sanhedrin saying that self-preservation would not allow you to murder an innocent person. If somebody tells you, puts a gun to your head and says, kill that innocent person or I'll kill you, we're not allowed to do it. But if it's a matter of self-preservation, of holding on to your jug of water, so that you are permitted to do. And it would seem like we have here outer parameters that on the one hand, active murder, to shoot someone else. So that is what we would call a formalist prohibition. In the philosophy of ethics, there are various schools, is how to relate to ethical questions and to ethical principles and rules. And among those schools, we know we have a formalist attitude where we say the rules are the rules and we have to stick to these rules and they're absolute and we can't make any calculations and decide that, okay, here's a justification to break the rules. We have to follow the rules absolutely. That's what we would call a formalist attitude. And there's another attitude we call a consequentialist attitude, where you look at what will result in a better situation, what will be a net gain for goodness, for morality, however we define it, and you make your decisions based on the consequences rather than based on rules. And in philosophy, these are various schools of thought, but in reality, many of the codes that we adhere to, the Torah, and I think our own personal philosophies in many cases, we're not absolute one or the other. We're not absolute formalists, and we're not absolute consequentialists either. It depends what the situation is. So, for example, I think most of us would lie in order to save someone else's life. We would decide that in that case, we could take a consequentialist attitude, and the ends justify the means, as the phrase goes. But for other issues, we take a more absolute formalist attitude. And the Talmud seems to be telling us that that's the case when it comes to murder. If you're going to murder someone else, you're not allowed to come to the calculation that that's okay if that person is innocent. And that's not a decision you're allowed to make. We take a formalist attitude. And it's interesting to consider why that is, why sometimes we would take a formalist attitude and sometimes we would take a consequentialist attitude, why we would say it's okay to lie to save someone's life, but it's not okay to murder someone to save someone's life. It seems, just to speculate, that when the stakes are higher, we're more uncomfortable with a consequentialist mindset, with making our own decisions. That becomes a harder thing to do when we're dealing with higher stakes, such as life and death issues. And as a society, we need to have a society that's adhering more to a rules-based system. In this case, the Gemara formulates it, the Gemara over there in Sanhedrin formulates it as, "My chazis, the dami didach, sumachi tvei midami didan," which means, how did you decide? How did you conclude that your blood is redder than his blood? The decision that you're going to make that you can murder that person to save your own life, how did you decide that your life is more valuable? And one could say that that's a formalist expression, saying essentially it's impossible to come to that conclusion. We have no way to ascertain, and therefore we have to make a policy, a formalist policy. We're never allowed to engage in these kind of calculations. Or we could say that it's just addressing the impossibility of actually figuring it out. That consequentially, maybe we could say that if we could assess that one person's blood was redder than the other, that would maybe affect things, but that's simply something that we can never do. However, it seems clear that that's not the case, that even if we can figure it out, because there is a debate in the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Rishalmi and Maseches Trumas, and there are different versions of this, but they all share a certain principle, different versions in the Talmud, that even if we're talking about a group of people, and it's not just that you're talking about killing one person to save a larger group, but that group includes that one person. So the Talmud discusses, let's say a gang of marauders would come and say, we're going to kill this entire group, we're going to kill all of you, unless you turn over one of your members for us to kill. And we find there that we're not allowed to turn over that one person to be killed, to participate actively in an act of murder, even though the consequence will clearly be worse, because that person himself will be murdered and the entire group will be murdered. So even when inarguably the consequences are clear, still apparently we're not allowed to take that step. There is this formalist prohibition of murder. That's not something that we can decide to do. And even though there are nuances in that discussion in Trumos, still everyone agrees on some level that there is a premise of an absolute attitude towards the prohibition of murder. And even though that same individual would be killed one way or another. In contrast, it would seem, looking at the Gemara in Bav Metzia, to now relate it in a little bit more detail, it seems like there the situation is different. The Gemara describes a situation where somebody is traveling in the desert together with someone else. There are two people traveling in the desert, and one of these individuals has a jug of water. And both of them are in a situation already of thirst, which is very dangerous. They are close to dying of thirst, but there's not enough water for the two of them. So the Talmud tells us that there was one figure, Ben Petura, who assessed the situation, and he said, better that the water should be split between the two of them, even though that means neither will survive. Nonetheless, that's what should happen. And one who takes the water should not see the other one die by keeping the water to himself. Rather, they should split the water, even though it's not enough. And then Rabbi Akiva comes, and it seems to be that this is the dominant position. Rabbi Akiva, who, among other things, is a far more prominent figure in the Talmud in this debate. Rabbi Akiva interprets the pasuk in Parsha Bahar just 2 weeks ago, where the Torah tells us in the context of Ribbis, he applies it here, the chei achicha imach, that you want to keep your brother alive together with you. But the emphasis on the last word, together with you, says Rabbi Akiva, chayecha kodem l'chayi chavercha, that your life, you have the right to preserve your life first before saving someone else's life. And of course, we remember that this is not only Rabbi Akiva, who's famous for so much, but among other things, he's famous for emphasizing that v'yahavta l'reicha kamocha zeh klal gadol b'Torah, that you have to see the needs of others as your own, you have to love your fellow and do whatever you can for your fellow, but still, if you have to choose, chayecha kodmin, that your life comes first. So what seems to emerge from that Gemara, if we're correct that Rabbi Akiva is the dominant view here, is that in a matter of preserving resources, so then you do have the right to say self-preservation will be the priority. And it would seem on the surface that the difference between the two to create two parameters is the Gemara in Sanhedrin is talking about active murder. There we take the formalist attitude that we're discussing. You're not allowed to make the calculation that I can justify this because it makes more sense or because it will help the world more or it will help me, it will save my life. But when it's not about active murder, it's about who will be saved by being able to use the water, so then that's a different discussion, and it's legitimate to say that your life comes first. However, we should emphasize that it's not so clear that that's exactly the situation here, and there is a lot of rabbinic commentary on that passage in Bava Metzia, in particular because Ben Petura's opinion seems extreme. To say that both should die, it doesn't really help anyone. Why should that be the proper attitude, even if it's not the accepted halacha? Why should that even be considered? Why should that even be recorded here as an opinion? So there is a lot of analysis as to what exactly is going on here. And it seems to suggest that at least it wasn't an obvious point that Rabbi Akiva had to come and interpret the pasuk in Parshas Bahar to teach us this. It wasn't something that was intuitively obvious. And there seems to be some other questions beneath the surface. For example, is there such a thing as passive murder? If you are going to stand by and let somebody die, does there any guilt that comes to you for doing so? Is that something? Clearly, we have an obligation normally of lo samar adam riacha, as we read in Parshas Kedoshim, we have an obligation not to stand by when somebody is dying and to save their life. So how absolute is that obligation? Is that obligation tied in to lo sertzach? There's some who suggest, the Ramban and others, that Parshas Kedoshim is an expansion of the Asaras HaDibros in many ways. So lo sertzach that we read on Shavuos is expanded to lo samar adam riacha. We have an obligation not only not to actively murder, but not to passively stand by. How much does that play a role in the discussion? There's also extensive commentary, the Chazon Ish, the Netziv, and others who discuss this Gemara, and they consider that perhaps the issue is the conflict between what we call Chayi Shah and Chayi Olam. Neither of those are absolute terms, but Chayi Shah would mean a temporary survival, living for a little while, but it's not going to last into the long term. While Chai Olam sounds like it means infinite life, but it means to really be saved, to be saved from this crisis, and to be able to live for a long time after this. Those are both subjective terms, but they can be contrasted with each other. So there are some who suggest that that's really the issue, that the one person who has the jug, he could keep it, and he'll make it through this crisis. So he will survive to the next step. That's what we'll call Chai Olam. But if he splits it with his friend, so then they'll both survive a little bit. They'll both last a little bit longer. That's Chayisha. And then who knows what will happen? Maybe there'll be some rescue team. Maybe something will change. So the question isn't as extreme as it seems that Ben Peturi said that both of them should die and that's the end of the story. Maybe the question was, one could save himself more absolutely and forget about the other one, or they could both take a risk further on and one would be trading his Chayolam, so to speak, for a Chayisha. And maybe that's the debate, and maybe that's where there is an issue. And the status of these two different levels, the idea that there is a concept of chayisha, of a temporary survival, as opposed to a more enduring rescue of a chayolam, so that we find in the Talmud in a few places. For example, on the one hand, the Gemara in Yuma tells us that we factor in chayisha in order to violate the Shabbos to save a life, that we'll be mechal Shabbos to save someone's life, even if we know that they're not going to really be saved from this crisis. They'll be they'll live a little while longer. They're very, very ill, and they're going to live only a short time longer. But nonetheless, we will be mechal Shabbos for that because we value life even at that level, even when it's only chayisha, and therefore inherently we do acknowledge that. Alternatively, the Talmud also says, though, that if it's a choice between chay olam and chayisha, so then we won't factor in chayisha as much. We will acknowledge the difference between the two. So, for example, this comes up in much contemporary literature about the question of somebody who's very ill in a life-threatening way, and they have the option of taking a path of surgery. They could have a surgery, and there is a risk that the surgery itself will be fatal. So the individual may die much sooner because of the surgery, or alternatively, the surgery is successful, so then they will be rescued from this crisis and they could live a significant period of time. They would really be rescued that have chay olam. So is one permitted to risk the chay isha in order to trade it for chay olam? That's a very relevant discussion, and many poskim take up that issue. It comes up in the context of many decisions that are made in contemporary medical ethics, and it perhaps relates to this whole issue, this whole debate maybe between Ben Peturi and Rabbi Akiva. So it does seem that on the one hand, we are drawing lines here, that if it's absolute murder, we have to be more formalist and see it as no calculations can be made. But if it's not active murder, but it's a life or death question that has other consequences, but not the action of murder itself, so then we have the right to look at it more consequentially, to consider the question of where will there be a greater chance of survival, whether it be chay olam, chay isha, who has the water, factors like that can come into the equation. We can take a more consequentialist attitude as long as we're not dealing with active murder. But that question has to be assessed. When is it a possibility that we're dealing with active murder? It's not always so clear. How do we define the difference between the two? And that's where we find a lot of commentary. And this is probably relevant to the trolley problem. Somebody mentioned a few before we started that last year when we met in person on the Shavuos program. So I spoke then about the trolley problem. I said, this isn't the same discussion. I'm going to overlap for a minute, but just to mention it for a minute. So the well-known philosophical conundrum, it's known as the trolley problem, involves the question of somebody sees a trolley that's on its way to hit five people. There are five people who don't know a trolley is going to come and kill them. And you have the opportunity to move the trolley out of the way and save the five lives. But the problem is that there's one person in the other path. So if you move the trolley away from the five people, you will hit one other person who was until now not threatened, and you'll cause his death in order to save the other five. And the question is posed, so is that a legitimate action to take? And the whole premise of the question seems to acknowledge the formalist attitude towards murder. Because if we took a consequentialist attitude, so it would seem like a very easy question. Save five people, we trade one for five. So from a consequentialist perspective, it seems clear that that's the better step. So the fact that this is such a challenging question, the fact that so many philosophers have spent so long thinking about this and writing entire books about it, reflects the fact that both in halacha and I think in very prevalent morality, we see murder as a formalist issue. And if we are talking about murder here, so then we're not going to allow it, even if the consequences seem to indicate that even if we could save five lives by murdering one, we're not ready to allow that. And the whole question of the trolley problem is, when is it called murder? Is that an act of murder to move the trolley into the path of some one person saving the other five? Is that called an act of murder or not? That seems to be the basic question, because it starts from the premise that if it was murder, then we wouldn't be allowed to make these calculations. And the Chazon Ish discussed a similar case, I think before Philippa Foot made this trolley question so famous. Chazon Ish, who died before that, Chazon Ish has a discussion about what happens if there's a missile that is headed towards a populated area. And you can divert the missile, you can push it away from the populated area. But what will happen is, then the missile is going to go to a less populated area. So in the aggregate, statistically, you'll save many lives, far fewer people will die, but you will cause the death of these people who were not threatened until now, and you caused that situation by diverting the missile into their path. Is that something that is permissible to do? It sounds similar in many ways, if not identical, to the trolley problem. And the Chazon Ish considered, he wasn't sure, but he considered, he thought that maybe this should be permitted. And the reasoning that he gives is fascinating and controversial. And he suggests that this act of diverting the missile away from the populated area, that is a Maisa Hatzala, that is an act of rescue, rather than a Maisa Shalachzarius, which you would normally translate literally into an action of cruelty. Presumably here the context would mean an action of aggression. And therefore the thesis here is that if you're performing an act of rescue, which may result in deaths, that is justifiable as opposed to an aggressive action against someone, which is not justifiable, even if it could end up saving more lives. And this is a controversial position. Rav Asher Weiss and Rabbi Bleich and others have taken issue with this position. But perhaps we could understand a little bit where the Chazon Ish is coming from, that the Chazon Ish is essentially saying that murder is a prohibition that is both formalist and consequentialist. It's consequentialist because it has a terrible effect on the world, as the Rambam spells out in Hilchos Rotzeach, that murder is one of the transgressions that has the worst negative impact on society. Clearly, it causes a lot of suffering and pain and mourning. And it's also a formalist prohibition, so it's prohibited as an action regardless of how much pain it causes or doesn't cause. So what the Chazon Ish seems to be saying is that if you have an act of murder, an aggressive act, so then that is called a formalist prohibition, and it doesn't matter that you will save more lives by doing so. But if it's not an act of murder, so then it's not covered by the formalist prohibition. The issue is that it's going to bring about a bad consequence. It's going to bring about the consequence of people dying. But there, once we're coming at it from a consequentialist angle, we should also have the right to say, but if the consequences will be worse if we don't do this, if more people will die if we don't do this, so then perhaps it's legitimate to come at it from a consequentialist perspective. But then the question still becomes, so why was the Chazon Ish not sure about this? Why did he not conclude absolutely? So as many later commentaries point out, and many earlier commentaries anticipating the issue point out, we have to figure out, how do you define what's called an act of rescue and what's called an aggressive action that also rescues people? How do you define it? And there are various suggestions. Some offer the possibility it's a question of how immediate it is. Will the people who end up dying, will they die immediately, or will that be a result later? Some suggest it's a question of, are you just moving out of the way of a missile, or are you manipulating the missile itself? Are you causing the harmful agent directly to hit the victims, or are you getting out of the way and the result is that the victims will get hit? Does it matter if it hasn't started yet, if the missile's not on the way yet? So all of these are suggested distinctions, which seem to emphasize that this is the issue. How exactly do we define what is an act of murder and what is not an act of murder, and allows us to focus on how we're doing the greater good and to make decisions from that perspective? So that certainly becomes the dominant question. We have to figure out, is what we're doing covered under Lo Sirtzach? Is it an action of murder, or is it not such a blatant violation? It's simply a question of the consequence, and therefore our mitzvah of saving lives could be addressed through more consequentialist thinking. And this becomes an issue in terms of medical care as well, because one might think, okay, here I'm deciding how to actively spend resources. There I should have a justification for a more consequentialist attitude. And that may be the case, but there are many important nuances that are discussed in the poskim. So, for example, for talking about a respirator. So if one is already on a respirator and the decision is made that that respirator would be more effectively utilized for a new patient, can that respirator be removed? Can the first patient be removed from the respirator and the respirator given to the second patient? That is a very controversial topic that Reb Schechter Shlita addressed in his recent tshuva. And that goes to the question of how exactly we are defining these actions. And that is one of the great points of controversy. But assuming that we could be satisfied that we're not talking about an action that risks being defined as lotzertzach, and we're talking about how to allocate life-saving resources, so then we get to our question of, do we have any ability to judge between people, to judge between patients, to say, okay, I will focus on this one before that one? What kind of considerations can we make? So here again, we have sources, and here again, we have a tension between the sources and much conflict as to what to do with them, because there are a few passages in the Talmud that sound like there are hierarchical systems, that sound like we make decisions based on various matters of personal status. And perhaps most well-known is a Mishnah in the end of Maseches Horias and Daf Yud Gimel, where the Mishnah seems to make decisions based on status and say, for example, a Kohen is saved before Yisrael, a man is saved before a woman, and the like. And you have a whole hierarchy over there. On the other hand, there may be a conflicting source, which also talks about status, or at least in terms of men and women, that the Gemara in Maseches Ksubis and Daf Samech Zayin, there the Gemara talking about staka, about sustaining orphans who need help. And there the Gemara says that one would give sustenance to a yesoma before a yasom, to a female orphan before a male orphan, that would be the priority. And there the Gemara gives some reasons, either because the pain of having to beg, the busha, the humiliation, will be greater for the female, or because the male has other ways of trying to seek out his sustenance that were not available to the female. So one way or another, it seems like these two Gemaras may be talking about the same thing, maybe talking about different things, but seem to have different conclusions and seem to have different systems. So just in terms of that question, the Mishnah in Hori is saying the man before the woman, and the Gemara in Ksuba is saying the woman before the man. So which is it? So there is a lot of discussion whether or not these passages are in conflict with each other and whether or not they have any applicability. But as far as practical halacha, so we find today that the poskim who talk about these issues, for the most part, they're almost across the board, do not factor in horios at all, do not factor in these, really either of these gemaras for this purpose, do not factor in any kind of hierarchical system or any kind of status differentiation. They're not saving men before women, they're not saving kohanim before yisraelim, they're not using any of these principles as far as making decisions. And there's a lot to discuss about why not, what exactly is the weight of the Mishnah in Horius. So there are some who suggest that we simply don't paskin like that Mishnah, that the source between, there's a conflict between the source in Ksubis and the source in Horius, and the source in Horius loses for whatever reason. And there are some who suggest that as a matter of practicality, perhaps neither source is really able to be functional. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, many others understand it's simply not something that's implemented in a practical way. And among other reasons, perhaps what the sources are trying to tell us is that there are certain factors, but the factors are not absolute. The factors are more statistical, and they don't necessarily reflect absolute issues that we can really make decisions based upon. So, for example, it sounds like in the Gemara Maseches Nazir that the Mishnah in Horius was talking about where is there a greater benefit to society. If there are people who provide more services for society, they should come first. And the Gemara was talking about types, about general categories where that seems to be true, but it's not necessarily always the case. So as Reb Schechter pointed out in his recent tshuva on this topic, he said, so nowadays, there are many women who are involved in Torah and mitzvahs and service to the community, many more than the average man. So we can't use that kind of a calculation and assume that there are any kinds of categorical decisions that are going to emerge from that Gemara. So functionally, and from that Mishnah, so functionally, it's not applicable. There's a fascinating discussion about this by Rav Chaim Hirshenson. Rav Chaim Hirshenson was a prominent Talmud Chacham and author who was a Rav in New Jersey, actually, about 100 years ago. And he wrote, among other things, the commentary to Hurrius. So in his comments, in the end of Hurrius, Anak Amari has a lot to say about this. And he understands, he thinks the sources are in conflict, that Hurrius and Ksubis are in conflict, and that they're both talking about staka. He says neither is talking about life-saving. They're both talking about giving financial sustenance. The language of the Mishnah in Hurrius, which is normally interpreted as saving a life, is lahachios, to give life. So he understands that to mean that we're talking about supporting financial. And the reasoning is fascinating. He says, why? Because if we were talking about life-saving, he thinks that follows the same logic of Lo Sirtzach. We would not be allowed to make any kind of differentials between people, not be able to say, okay, this one before that one. It would be subject to the same formalism of active murder of Lo Sirtzach, and therefore that can't be what Hurrius is talking about. It must be talking about who to support financially, lahachios, that must be what it means, and therefore we're talking about who's involved or who tends to be involved in more things on behalf of the community. But even if so, he says, so the Gemara in Ksubas tells you differently, and that seems to be the end of the day. That seems to be the final decision. One way or another, we don't have to necessarily dismiss, Hurrius dismiss either source to say that it doesn't play much of a role. It seems like it's giving one of many considerations. And in fact, if you look at the Gemara over there in Hurrius, you see that there are many different factors that are brought into the discussion. And therefore, the Gemara in Ksubas is not necessarily contradicting it, but is also bringing in different considerations. And all of these factor into the large discussion. But as a matter of practice, so status differential, looking at people in some kind of a hierarchical system, that's not something that we find put into practice at all. And the other considerations, some of which do emerge from the Gemara in Ksubas or elsewhere, maybe become more relevant. So we find in the poskim many, many different considerations that actually are brought into the discussion. So for example, does it matter who came first? If the hospital is bringing in patients, so do we say that whatever patient came in first, that's the patient who gets the attention, and that's how we prioritize? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, for example, put greater focus on that than other poskim did, and put greater focus on that rather than the issue of, let's say, chai olam versus chai isha, that if you have two patients and you assess that one of them you'll be able to help a little bit, but they won't survive long, and the other one you have a chance of really saving and getting them past this crisis and rescuing them. So other poskim, such as Rav Asher Weiss and such as Rav Shechter, so they assume that that's really the more crucial factor, a chai olam versus chai isha consideration will make a bigger difference. And Rav Moshe felt that first come, first serve is a bigger consideration. And other factors, Rav Shlomo Zalman and others have tshuvas about this, where they bring in also the question of, does it matter if you started working on one patient? Does that become your absolute responsibility, regardless of the considerations for a second patient? Does it matter which one is in more urgent need of help? One is going to die sooner without attention than the other. So there we find different aspects of the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh being brought into the discussion. How good of a job can you do in pikuach nefesh? Or how urgently is your pikuach nefesh needed? So we gauge it through potential success. We gauge it through urgency, through what's presenting it. These are all factors that are part of the discussion and may sometimes be in contradiction with each other, but all become a part of the discussion. Are there other resources that perhaps could be available to one person rather than the other? Rav Hirschenson, in his discussion, he notes that that consideration of other resources, that interestingly could cut both ways, because somebody who's more self-sufficient, if you're looking at the Hurrius considerations of more benefit to society, so maybe you'll say somebody who's more self-sufficient would be prioritized. But on the other hand, if we're looking from an urgency perspective, so one who has other resources, we would say they should come second to the one who doesn't have other resources. So these factors can both be complex and internally contradictory. They could themselves point in different directions at the same time. And that's a part of the complexity of the issue. Does it matter if there's an established protocol? That's something that Rav Hirschenson discusses. He doesn't necessarily accord so much weight to this, but he talks about what was more recent history in his time about the Titanic and the question lifeboat ethics of people being saved off of the Titanic with limited lifeboats, and the great Jewish philanthropist Isidore Strauss died died on the Titanic. He drowned together with his wife because he refused to be saved before other passengers. And he has a discussion of whether or not that was halachic thinking. He says it was a Kiddush Hashem one way or another, but he's not convinced it was halachic thinking. But he goes through the whole discussion there. He talks about the concept of ladies first. To what extent does halacha have such a recognition or not? How would that fit into this whole discussion? So he talks there about this question of established protocols. How does that fit in? Or it may be that there's no other way to make a decision, and Rav Moshe Feinstein considers the possibility that maybe a lottery, maybe a goral might be the right way to do it if there is no other possible factor. But there are many other considerations that are discussed. There's a fascinating analysis, there's a very lengthy essay about this by Rav Shlomo Daichovsky, who's a prominent dayan in Eretz Yisrael. And a collection of his essays called Lev Shomei LeShlomo, where he talks about many factors, but there are some factors that are dismissed outright. So for example, Rav Asher Weiss in his writings, so he has noted that one thing he's sure cannot be a factor is that if we're talking about life and death issues, about life-saving issues, so a doctor can't decide this one's going to pay me more, so therefore I have my discretion to choose that patient over the other if it's a matter of life and death. And he understands that essentially as a form of bribery, that we have to have some objective system, even if we don't have absolute confidence what the objective system is, but we have to at least have some attempt to go through it through the internal considerations of halacha and not say that my financial interest is going to push me in one direction or the other. And together with this, there are other halachic considerations, perhaps the question of, do we look at it through maybe a consequentialist perspective? Where will you find greater success in the mitzvah of Pikuach Nefesh and the common good and bringing about more good to the world? Or maybe we also look at it as a question of a personal obligation. To what extent are you fulfilling your mitzvah of Pikuach Nefesh for your own spirituality? Rav Asher Weiss dismisses that as a consideration, but it's also a part of the back and forth here. And all of this goes into the mix. And on the one hand, it may be disheartening that here we look to halacha to guide us, and we are a people of the book, a people of such a rich literature, so we would look for more absolute answers in matters of such importance, such great life and death questions. We would expect perhaps more absolute answers, but at the same time, that is the beauty of the halachic system, that it reflects the fact that we have such deep concern for the value of life, for protecting life, and for not ending life unjustifiably, that we have to very carefully weigh every factor and acknowledge that there are variables that may lead to questions. And we have to consider, when are we approaching the category of active murder of Lo Sirtzach, and understand that there's a red line there. And then even once we've ascertained that that's not necessarily the case, if we can say so with confidence, then the consequentialist decisions that we make, separate from this formalist consideration, that also becomes a subject of very careful analysis of each factor that may bear upon how well we are doing in our mandate of heroic behavior and our mandate to save life. So that itself is the beauty of the system, as much as it leaves us frustrated, as much as it leaves us perhaps hoping for more clarity, but the recognition that our system and our values require such attention to every component, to every detail that might be relevant, that perhaps is more reflective than anything else. And in a topic like this, perhaps we can say that the questions are themselves the answer. So I hope that gives a little bit of perspective to a very weighty question that has no absolute answer for now. And I know that we're over time, so I'm not going to take the time to review, but I hope I gave a little bit of clarity, and I wish all of you a safe and healthy, uplifting, and inspiring Shavuos.
Feldman, you have another 2 minutes if you want to review quickly.
So I'll just very quickly to review.
Five minutes,
okay. So just to very quickly, what did we speak about? So we talked about the question of how do we allocate resources when we're involved in life-saving and we don't have enough, whether it's respirators, ventilators, or medical attention, or anything in between. And we talked about, it seems like there are parameters laid out by two sources. On the one hand, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which tells us that murder is Yehareg Val Yavor, that we have a formalist attitude towards murder. We can't do it even for self-preservation. On the other hand, the Gemara in Bav Metzia, which seems to conclude that if it's not absolute murder, but we're saving our own life through preserving our own resources, such as a jug of water, so then we are allowed to do that even at the expense of someone else who's not going to get those resources. So it would seem like murder is formalist, that we have a prohibition that's absolute. We can't make any calculations. The Gemara attributes it to a logical statement of my chazis, how did you decide that your blood is redder than his, which may be an expression of formalism. We simply can't go there, or maybe an expression of frustrated consequentialism. We just simply have no way of assessing. But it seems like from the Yerushalmi and Trumas that even if we could assess that this same person will die one way or another, and it's a question of killing that one person to save the whole group, we're still not permitted to do it, clearly showing that it is an absolute formalist principle in that case. But in the second situation, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, so we saw that there it's a little bit more complex than it seems. Ben Petura said that two people traveling in the desert, both dying of thirst, one of them has a jug of water, he's obligated to split it even though they both die and he shouldn't see his friend die. And Rabbi Akiva came and said, no, you get to live first. So it sounds like that is the difference between the two, but it's important to note that there's a lot of discussion as to what exactly Ben Petur's position is. It may have to do with the concept of passive murder or the range of the obligation of Losamar Dam Reyacha, or the question of maybe there's a contrast here between Chai Isha and Chai Olam, that maybe both of them could survive a little bit and who knows what will happen, or the other one is thinking, if I take all the water, I will definitely make it through this crisis, and it's a chayi olam consideration. And we find that the Gemara in a few places brings up the two both by themselves and comparatively. We know that a chayi shah is enough to be mechal Shabbos for, but it's not necessarily considered as much when it's up against chayi olam. So a person, for example, in the modern literature, a person is often permitted to take a risky surgery with many other details considered, but to take a risky surgery and risk their chayi shah for the hope of a possible chayi olam afterwards. That becomes a very important question, figuring out, is there murder involved or not? And that's probably the issue with the trolley question. The trolley question seems to, on a consequentialist perspective, say definitely go for it and save the five at the expense of the one. But the question is it a formalist prohibition of murder? Is this an act of murder or not? And we saw the Chazanish's discussion in a similar situation about diverting a missile, where he drew a distinction between an act of rescue that has negative consequences and an aggressive action that will also save someone. And he wasn't sure whether that was a valid distinction or not. And we saw that some of the literature addresses the question of just how do we make such a distinction. We don't know exactly where to draw the line, and that's a part of it. But this also comes up in life-saving questions in terms of medical care. So, for example, if one patient is already on a respirator, is it permitted to take that patient off the respirator to provide it for someone else? Would that be considered murder? Would that be considered an action? That's a part of the discussion that we find in the literature, including the recent response of Rav Schechter and of Asher Weiss. So assuming that we can clear that issue away, so if we know that we're not dealing with active murder, or if we're confident we're not dealing with active murder, so then the question becomes, how do we make distinctions? How do we have the ability to choose? So we have some conflicting sources about that also. Two sources which seem to have hierarchical status distinctions, the Mishnah in Horius and the Gemara in Ksubis, Horius preferring men over women, Ksubis preferring women over men. Neither of which seems to have a big impact with halacha. We discussed different possibilities why. It could be that Horius simply is not accepted with halacha. The Rambam doesn't bring it in his code, by the way, as the Tzitzeliezer points out and others point out. So it could be that that was not accepted, maybe because it's in conflict with Subas, maybe for other reasons. Contemporary posts can point out it's simply not practical, and maybe it's showing some kind of a theoretical concept which isn't necessarily applicable or isn't necessarily relevant. So, for example, if the consideration is who categorically has a greater role in society, so that's something which isn't even necessarily true nowadays, and it doesn't certainly apply categorically. So for whatever reason, those two sources don't have such a great impact. Other considerations are brought into the discussion, such as who came first. Rav Moshe puts a bigger focus on that than Chai Olam versus Chai Isha. Other poskim, Rav Schechter, Rav Asher Weiss, and others assume that that's a much bigger consideration. Who may have the possibility of Chai Olam? Who could be saved past this crisis as opposed to someone who's only going to have a temporary extension, but does not have a good prognosis for a longer life? Does it matter who's been worked on first? Does it matter who has other possibilities to rescue them? Who has other alternatives? Does it matter who's sicker? All of these focusing on different aspects of the mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, what exactly is the best fulfillment of it, the most accomplishment or the most urgency or things like that. We also discussed the possibility that it might make a difference if there's an accepted protocol, not necessarily factored in so much. We talked a little bit about Rav Hirschman's writings about the Titanic incident and Isidore Strauss, who passed away because he refused to be saved before others, and how the impact of decisions in that context. We talked about maybe even a lottery might be something which may need to be a recourse, as Ramosha points out.
1105.
So many other considerations, and we noted that the questions are the answer here, that the fact that all of these are important considerations is itself the most relevant. I thank you, and I wish you a